This is Dykes on Mics. And today, tonight, Phyllis Knight, author of Switching the Odds. And I guess when I read it, I thought, classic hard-boiled detective story with a twist. And I guess the twist is she's female and she's a lesbian. So welcome.
Well, thank you.
Now, you used to live in Montreal.
Yes, for 3 years and then a year in the townships.
Okay, and now you're in Maine.
Right.
And I don't really know where to start. We could, well, may as well start with the book, I suppose. Eh?
Sure.
Yeah,
because sure,
there's lots of background stuff and other things that you've done, and the band thing, but we'll get to that later.
Sure.
Now, when I read the book, what occurred to me was that there were so many descriptive passages, the road trips, food, recipes, music. So I had it confirmed by Laurence at Landogin that, in fact, a lot of that was you.
Absolutely. Well, fictionalized to a great degree, but the music has been such a big part of my life that there's no way I could not write about music if I write. So it's a good way of getting something you know in there.
And Lil Richie is definitely, she definitely knows what she likes.
She does. She does.
And she knows where to go find it. So I guess maybe a synopsis of the book for listeners, just so they...
Okay. Lil is a detective, private detective, living in coastal Maine. She's a ex-musician, a rhythm guitar player, and singer. I haven't really had her singing in this group, but in a future book she's going to be singing.
Oh, is she?
Right.
Oh.
And she, for her own reasons, which I won't reveal because of the plot of the book, she's ended up in Maine. She's lived in Texas a lot. She's a Virginia-born person, and she's traveled around quite a bit. She's lived a few places, and she's found herself in Maine. In this book, she gets a call about a runaway teenager. The case, of course, ends up being a lot complicated. It starts off in Maine, where the boy's father believes he's run off to his own father's house in Tillman, Maine, where Lil lives. And the case ends up taking her to Virginia and Texas and back again to Virginia before she can figure out the big tangle that has happened in this boy's life, who has witnessed something he should not have witnessed. And so Lil ends up really pushed to the wire, trying to protect everyone who needs protecting, including herself.
And the client is a rich guy, and she rents a lot of cars.
Yeah. She rents a lot of cars. She stays in great hotels.
Yeah, she does. She does. There's a particular line I like now,
okay,
where she says, "I love motels," and I can relate to that. If you don't stay in motels too often, and you're on the road, there's something just fun about plunking down a bit of money, stepping into a room, and, well, checking out what's there, because it's yours for the night.
It's your temporary home. You can do what you like, and the next day, you've got another one.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to worry. No fuss, no muss.
No muss. And you hop into the rented car. You don't have to worry about that either.
That's right. Just drive the hell out of it.
What do you think, since you wrote the book, what makes it a little bit different? I mean, besides the fact that she's a lesbian, there's still something else happening. It's quite classic in terms of detective story genre, I suppose, but then there's so many elements that that are funny and
that's good.
Interesting angles.
Well, I figured that Lil, being a woman and being a lesbian, was not going to be one of these detectives who's hard-boiled, has an entirely lonely life.
All right.
She's going to be connected. She's going to have friends. Her particular nature, she doesn't live any sort of segregated life. She likes a great variety of people. One thing that's unusual about her, she's a very trusting person. She's skeptical also, so she's not a fool, but she's trusting. And she can, people trust her. She knows, she goes on instincts a lot and intuition, and she trusts that. And it seems to work for her. That's one thing that's different about her. And she talks about a lot of concerns that most of us living in this part of the 20th century have, I believe, about the state of the world.
Oh, yes, she does. Well, there's a section on race relations in Texas between the African-American and Spanish-American fellas and her views on that.
Right, and in the part of the Charlottesville, Virginia part, there, she comes up against a woman police lieutenant in the South.
Yeah.
A strong character who will be in another book.
Oh, of course. She's too good. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
She popped off the page at me. I hadn't expected that to happen. She was originally going to be a male policeman, and I suddenly went, I don't want Lil being intimidated by some male cop.
Yeah.
Hell with this. And suddenly, this person just jumped out at me, and I went, ah. Now I found my character.
That's her.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lil is at once pretty strong and quite vulnerable at different times.
She is.
And that's rather human, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know?
She, that's it. She's a... Also, another thing I really want to do with this character is that from book to book, many of these detective novels don't show the price of the life that these detectives live. And Lil's going to be a real human being with a real range of emotions, and I want her to grow and change and take things in. And for instance, in the second book, which I'm not through with yet, she's dealing with some of the things that happened in the first book. And I want to keep her real.
Because it is going to be Lil's life. She's a private
Lil's
detective,
life.
And we'll peek in on a few of the cases.
Right.
Can you give us a basic idea of the second book, or would you rather not?
Well, sure. She's since music is a big part of her life, it's a good way to show who she is and who she is underneath. And she has been... It deals with a case of a musician, a great jazz musician, who sort of has a wonderful cult following, who has hit some really hard times, and Lil takes it very personally because of her own past and some things that have happened in her life regarding music and musician friends.
Right.
To really put herself out into finding a solution to his troubles as much as she can. And Lil is a way also, she finds her ways of getting justice as much as she can. It's, you know, you can't do it every day in daily life, but if you write, you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, did you not say something about, what was it? If you're a writer, you can dramatize, you can fictionalize anything, or, you know, perhaps I'm mucking up the quote.
You can do that. Well, my famous quote now,
let's have it. That's
someone
what
wrote down for me, that's why it's so famous, is that being a writer is being like God, but without the responsibility.
Okay, that's a new one. I haven't heard that.
That's a new one, okay.
What about your musical past, which has a lot to do with the evolvement of Lil Richie?
When I was a small child, my sister and I were jumping around singing in the front yard. This is in the Virginia South, and... suddenly I lapsed into harmony, and we went, wow, what is this? We both stopped jumping. We went, what did we do? And then we started singing and did it again. And my mother, who's a piano player, she's kind of a piano banger. She likes to play old Fats Domino stuff and rock and roll. Got really excited. And so this is rock and roll was just coming out. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis Presley. And so my mother would teach us. I was probably about 7 when we started singing around the state. Teach us these new rock and roll songs, and my sister and I were the singing night sisters. And we sang all around the state in contests with other little kids all dressed up in satin dresses. And then later on, we did TV and radio, and all over the state, really. I was an extremely shy little kid, and in seventh grade, we'd be playing in this radio show in Richmond, Virginia. They went out over 26 states. They had 3,000 people in the audience. And I'd come back to school. I still was this little shy kid who didn't have any friends, and somebody would say, did we hear you on the radio? And I went, yeah, well, maybe. That's how I started. But we started having a family band then. I started playing guitar when I was 11. And then so we had a family band until mid-60s. And then I switched. I got a 12-string and was on the folk circuit for years. I was involved heavily in the coffee house in Charlottesville, Virginia for 8 years. That wonderful people came in and out of it. Emily Lou Harris played there all the time. It was a great place. And from then, I got tired of doing folk music and started a band with 5 other people who had been involved at the coffee house. 5 incredibly individual people.
And where's this now?
This is in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay, we're still there.
Yeah, and so we played all around Virginia and stuff for the next 3 years and moved to Texas. We went on the road. All the guys thought they could meet chicks. That's what was a great quote at the time, and I kept saying, sit tight, you know, maybe we get a recording contract, but you couldn't do a thing with them. So we ended up in Austin, Texas, and when the band broke up, which wasn't long, there were only 2 of us who stayed, actually, and I was one of them. I came out in Austin, Texas, And my friend Richie, who had been, Little Richie gets her name right from him.
No kidding.
And he was a bass player, and he stuck with me, and we got a woman who was my first lover, actually, Nancy, who played electric viola, a classical
Ooh.
Musician who loved to play rock and roll. So we had
what
our band
cool.
Violet Crown, and we played around Austin for 3 years.
Whew.
And since then, I've done this and that, but no bands, really, but I've played around a lot. I played the women's bar circuit for a little while in Austin around there. Played in San Francisco when I lived there.
Did it just kind of peter out, the music career? I mean, in terms of what, where you wanted to live and what else you wanted to do? And
that was the trouble. We started moving around a lot, and some people can just put a notice on a bulletin board and say, I need a drummer or I need a piano player. And I'm not like that. I'm a homey person. I like to play with my friends. And so it just didn't work out that it was easy to find musicians. And so when I got to Maine, in Maine, it's weather like Montreal, but it's worse. It's in the country, and it's very hard, and the roads are very icy all winter, and it's hard to get anywhere. So a lot of the year, you're semi-isolated, and it was a good place to concentrate on writing. Really what happened with the music, it was that I wasn't getting very much done with music or writing because I was dabbling. I was doing a bit of this and a bit of that. And I really decided to make a concentrated effort and see if I could get a book out, see if I could figure out how to do it. And at the end of that, if I was writing full time, then I'd have time to do some music. So I'm about to, I'm crossing my fingers to see if I get a grant that I've applied for that just any day now. If I do that, I'm buying a 12-string, and I hope to play around a little bit. It'll be easier than carrying a lot of electrical equipment around.
Right, right, right. Try to get it in one case.
Right. Hmm.
So, if you get the grant, you can write full-time.
Right.
And then when you're taking breaks from writing, you can play.
Yeah, that's it. Instead of being in a library 4 days a week,
right,
checking books in, checking books out, which I've stopped.
Oh, I was just going to ask you that.
3 weeks ago, I said, goodbye. I've got to go now.
Oh, really?
Well, I figured I could work for $6 an hour for many more years, or I could do something, the work that I found that I love, which is writing. It's the only work I've done a trillion low-paying jobs. It's the only work I've ever had where I don't look at the clock. I don't worry about the lunch break. I can be working on a sentence. There's sentences I could point them out to in the book that literally maybe I sat there for 2 hours to get it just right. And I don't mind losing that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I love every bit of it.
It's your time. It's productive time.
That's it.
That's part of the process.
And it's creative work. And I would never imagine that you would do any other work if you could do creative work.
Oh, you're positively beaming, Phyllis.
I love it. Can't help it.
Oh, it shows. That's wonderful. Okay, well, no more librarian questions then. That's a past career.
My former life.
Would you like to do a reading?
Sure.
Short, or we'll go for the short one.
Okay. For those of you who haven't read the book, which I suppose are most of you who are listening, there is a lot of food and music. And this is really page 8 of the book. Nothing too much is happening. She's started a case, and she's gone home to think about it.
Yeah.
I know that people who live alone are only supposed to eat macaroni and cheese right out of the box, but I thought I'd save that for tomorrow night. On my way home, I heard a familiar, lonesome cry for gumbo and made a small detour to the fish truck that usually parked on top of the hill near the gas stations and fast food joints leading out of town. A pint of oysters, some fresh crab meat, a pound of shrimp, and a small piece of hake would be transformed into food fit for the gods, if indeed the gods lived in the bayou country. My upstairs neighbor Fred's truck wasn't in its usual place in the driveway when I got home. I rent the main part of the house, but an earlier owner built a small apartment out of a couple of rooms upstairs, with its own outside entrance around the back. I like living alone, but it's also nice to have a neighbor that close. Littlefield was sleeping when I opened the back door. By the time I set the fish bag on the kitchen counter, he'd rallied enough for a spontaneous vocal improvisation at my feet. Actually, it was sort of between my feet. When he started rubbing against my legs, I knew he'd figured out it was a gumbo night. More than once, I thought there must be some way to make a buck out of a gumbo-eating cat, but so far, he'd only cost me fish and money. I quickly chopped 2 cups each of onions, green peppers, and celery, and added a handful of chopped garlic to the bowl and set it aside. I poured a cup of good olive oil into my cast-iron pot, and when the oil was smoking hot, I added a cup of unbleached white flour. This is the most important moment in Cajun cooking. Here you've got 2 choices. You can stand there and stir the roux for the next hour and a half to get it to the deep, nearly black color you want. Or you can whisk like hell for the next 5 minutes on the highest heat you've got. In the end, if it hasn't burned, the roux would be just right. Tonight, the magic was working. When the roux was finished, I turned the heat off under the pot, added the vegetables, and stirred until the sizzling stopped. Then I put in some bay leaves, hot peppers, and other spices, and added enough fish stock to fill 2/3 of the pot. Now would come the long, slow simmering required for almost all good food. In 2 hours, I could add the seafood, and 10 minutes after that, Littlefield and I would be deep into serious eating pleasure. I popped the cap on a bottle of Dos Equis and picked up Littlefield on the way to the stereo. It was going to be the blues tonight. The only question was which blues I'd start with. Looking through my record collection can take quite a while. I've been loving music all my life and playing guitar for most of it. Along the way, I've managed to collect a little bit of everything I like, and I like the three cousins, blues, jazz, and rock, the best. I picked out Alligator Records' Living Chicago Blues No. 4 and was soon enjoying the fine sounds of Queen Sylvia Embry as she wove her lyrics around the heart. One thing led to another, and after Queen Sylvia had finished, I put on another old favorite, a sweet, sad song called Tell Me About the Moon. Its singer broke my heart for the umpteenth time. Been lonely 21 years, never had nobody like you. Been crying too many tears, never thought I would find you. I filled my old clawfoot bathtub with hot water, dropped in a linen bag of lavender buds, and lay back to enjoy the bath, the music, and the beer. Missing persons cases tend to follow you home, though. As soon as I closed my eyes, my thought wandered around among a restless boy, an old drunkard, and a man of business who wanted one of them for the wrong reasons and seemed to have only a heart full of hatred for the other. When I got back to the living room, I went back to the Chicago Blues and listened to Scotty and the Riptips sing about a big-legged woman in a short, short miniskirt. As Scotty tried to get her to promise to treat him right, I cut the fish up into inch-and-a-half chunks and added them and the seafood to the bubbling pot of gumbo. I warmed up a little rice. That would go into the bottom of my bowl along with a generous sprinkling of filet powder. My rule about filet is this: if it doesn't make you sweat after the third bite, add some more. I had two big bowls of gumbo, and Littlefield did his best to keep up. After dinner, I stacked the dishes in the sink and put on an old Charles Mingus record I've had for nearly 20 years. I made a cup of espresso and settled down into my ancient recliner with a book by Eudora Welty, who is to literature what Mingus was to jazz. Littlefield came on board toward the end, after the coffee was finished. Soon after that, I fell asleep and dreamed of wandering endlessly along the dusty dirt roads of mid-depression Mississippi in a bitter and unforgiving heat.
She rolled her eyes. Well, that's Detective Lil Richie at home.
Kicking back.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Does she have a lover? She doesn't, I guess. That's the impression I get.
She has a little black book.
Well, she mentioned that one, yes. And there is actually a point at which she refers to a splendid evening all set up with some very nice female company, and the phone rings.
Her case calls her.
She's got to go.
She doesn't want to go. She's a little high. She's having fun, and she has to go. She gets home, and her bed is empty.
Yeah.
Sad but true.
But she has friends.
She has friends.
And she'll be fun.
And she lives in a place that has millions of tourists in the summer. And many of those are women, I would expect. So we haven't finished this story.
You must be quite a cook. I mean, you've just that's probably another twist to the whole detective story. We've got a recipe for gumbo in the book.
Right. That's one way I've made my living quite a bit. I've cooked in lots of places.
Oh, like little restaurants and...
Deli in Virginia, a couple restaurants in Austin, Texas, one which actually had the best gumbo in town, which I just made it according to their recipe. It wasn't my thing doing.
Oh, your touch, though.
A little bit. The fun thing about that place, it's a club that's really well known there, Liberty Lunch, and we were the house band there before our band folded. And later on, I was cook, and they were creative people, and they said, you know, every night I had to make a special and out of whatever was in the refrigerator, and they'd say, use all your creative efforts, name it anything you want. And so I would have fun naming these really weird dishes every night. And at one point I was getting ready to leave to move to San Francisco, and everybody thought I would have already gone, and they kept saying, I thought you'd left yet. And so one night I was cooking, and my friends who had a women's band were getting ready to play, and I knew I would hear questions all night. It was driving me nuts. So I had some sort of lasagna with don't ask me no questions garlic bread. And let me tell you, I didn't hear a squeak.
Yeah, got him.
Got him.
The contract, the book contract, the idea that you now have before you, a hardcover book with a lovely jacket.
Thank you. I was really pleased with the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
It's artwork. And, you know, you worry if you write mysteries about dead bodies on covers, and, you know, this is just a little peek into Lil's office, and you look at it and you want to know what's going on and what's going to go on in there. It's intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she's got, for listeners, it's quite a, well, it's a bare office. There's a cigarette in the ashtray. We're looking in through the window. Brownstone. There's a cowboy hat on the rack,
right.
And there's a studded suede jacket, let's say, on the back of the chair with the two women's symbols joined together in studs.
Yep.
Bit of paperwork on the desk, and the picture hanging on the wall is crooked.
Yes, I was so offended by that part. I would never have a crooked painting on my wall. Well, I might, but just for a minute.
Oh, but that's Lil
might.
Though,
that's
yeah.
I know, that's it. Lil might.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's Lil? Why the name Lil, anyway?
It just came to me. I got Lil before I got the rest of the book. I came up with the character before I had any idea of what she was going to be like.
Yeah.
And originally her name was, I have Lil swimming a lot. I'm a swimmer. I love to swim.
Yes, I noticed that.
And so while I was swimming laps in the Holiday Inn in Ellsworth, Maine, Lil Diamond came to me. And Diamond is a name you hear around there. And when I sold the book, my editor said, you got to change that name. It sounds too much like Diamond Lil, and she's a deeper person than it sounds like. It sounds too facile. And so I ended up changing it. Richie is a good, she's a Southern person, and it's a good Appalachian name, and it's a little salute to my friend, my brother, right. Rich Latimer. So.
Right. Well, we got way off topic, actually.
What did we talk about?
Well, we were talking about the contract when you finally got this. Now, that must be a pretty good story.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, first I talked to an agent of a friend of mine who's a well-known mystery writer, and he turned me on to her agent, who wasn't sure what to do with the book. She's not a reader and didn't know how to take it. Instead, gave me the name of another person who she knew of, who was an agent who has a gay bookstore in New York, and. So I wrote him a letter saying, I don't want small press. I would like a big audience. And I think Lil is a person who can touch a lot of different people. I like her to have a big audience for that.
Huh.
And he said he wanted to read the book, and he read it and liked it and said, I don't see a problem with that. And he was very, he didn't make a big deal about it. And he just said, I think we can do that. So when I sent him the manuscript, he had a couple of changes that he talked about. And there were good ones. It wasn't anything much, just a little something. And so he told me to send him three copies of the manuscript. And last summer, I sweated it out while everyone was on Long Island for the summer, and nothing was getting done. And so I talked to him, and I guess around the end of August, beginning of September, when he thought people really were getting back from their vacations. And the third editor who had a copy of the book was St. Martin's, Michael Denny. And he said he wanted it. And people say it takes years, and Norman had even told me that it could take ages and ages and ages, maybe we'll have to start small presses, but the editor liked the book and likes the idea of a series. We've talked about plots for future books. He's a gay man who came out of Stonewall and is a great heart and saw what I was trying to do. Excited to support her. I feel like a very lucky duck.
Mm-hmm. Timing, though, is everything.
It is.
You know, and I guess that's part of it, that the book was written, the idea was right, and somebody also at the other end
right.
thought the very same thing.
Well, one thing I've discovered, it takes a lot of people to make a book.
Mm-hmm.
The writer writes it, and at every point, things have been very cooperative. They've all felt very brotherly and sisterly. it's a major publisher, but it hasn't seemed like a cold thing. Everybody that I've had to deal with has been just wonderful. And yeah, that's it. There's luck involved. You have to hope you have good work, and that people will see that. But you also you're dependent on everyone's goodwill and best wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important ingredient that I do not take lightly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very serious thing.
Yeah, the energy that everybody wants to put into a project, I guess.
And it's from my part of it, I've tried to put very good energy into it, and that's all I've gotten back. So,
and it's working.
That's so far.
Is this what did you think when you started sending your manuscripts around? Did you think that this was a possibility, or were you more along the, well, it probably will take years if ever? And
well, this is interesting because it's not that I've done a lot of different things in my life, and I've switched doors in midstream quite a bit, but I've been incredibly directed toward this the whole time I was writing. Mm. I knew exactly what I wanted to do and where I was going to push it, and maybe some of it was totally ignorance is bliss. You know, I didn't know how long it took, and I didn't care, but I thought it was going to work, and I said, oh, it'll do it, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd known the odds, maybe I wouldn't have been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you were just going with what you felt was the next step.
That's it. And if you've done creative, with me, I've done creative work my entire life. You know, I started writing songs when I was even a kid. And when you've done creative work your whole life, you can feel when things are right.
Mm-hmm.
And like Lil trusts her instincts and her intuition, well, so do I.
So do you. And the contract you have with St. Martin's then is for a series.
Well, they have first refusal on the second book.
What does that mean?
They get it first.
Okay.
They get to choose it. I mean, to say, yes, I want it, or no, they don't want it. But maybe this is, again, an ignorance is bliss, but I'm not worried about it, really. Michael, my editor, knows what it's about, and he's excited, and, I hope it just keeps going well.
Okay, so potentially, yes, there's definitely another Lil Richie.
And there'll be a paperback coming out from this one, and it'll be a little cheaper for those of us who don't make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think with from working in a library for years, one thing that I know is that things start slowly usually, but if you like a book and it's a series and you want the others.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you get interested in the character, I think, and
that's
so
it.
You just want to know more about her.
That's it. And that's why I chose mystery series. I mean, I could do a variety of kinds of writing, and maybe someday I'll write novels that are not mysteries, but it's a great way to explore a character. There's, you know, you don't have to do it in one book. You can really go through someone's life a bit and get the little nugget that is just golden in there and show it.
Oh, that's nice.
Just
well
thought that
put.
Out.
And the book launch now. The book was launched last night at L'Inde d'Origine. That's on Saint-Laurent between Prince Arthur and Pine. I'm sure you've heard that mentioned many times. Anyways, the book is going to be selling at L'Inde d'Origine for the next little while, for sure.
Oh,
it's
yes.
In hardcover right now. And as Phyllis said, it'll be in paperback at some point. How was the book launch?
It was a lot of fun. Some people I didn't know showed up. Some people I knew and hadn't seen in a trillion years showed up, including a couple of friends from the States. I was totally taken aback. And there was a vat of guacamole and some beer, and people had a good time and stayed late. Lawrence finished cleaning up the store at midnight, he said, so I think that's a good party.
Oh, that's terrific. You did used to live here.
Yes,
so I guess you had some friends from here that...
Yeah, I lived on De Bouillon, right near Duluth. It's the one building in all of Montreal that's not renovated since I left.
How long ago?
We moved, I think we lived there until maybe 82, and then we lived on off of L'Esplanade for few months, and then we moved into near Aeriscliff in the Eastern Townships.
Eastern Townships.
Yeah, and we actually moved to Texas from there.
Oh, that's quite a move.
All of our moves have been cross-country moves. And not necessarily having been planned a lot in advance.
Well, you can tell you've traveled a lot from reading the book. Again, you know, Little Richie does not, she doesn't just commute in town in rented cars. She travels clear across the country in rented cars.
Right.
And back.
Well, that's something I'm going to keep in this series. Being a Southern writer, sense of place is very important to me, but I've moved around so much. My sense of place is, I can call it sense of places. And so I decided early on when I was writing, if I wasn't going to have that be a disadvantage, the fact that I'd moved around a lot, I would have to turn it into an advantage and have a character who'd moved around a lot. And she knows a fair amount about a few places, and they're just the places that have touched her heart more than others, which obviously in the first book, Austin, Texas, really had touched her heart. And I had a review in the Charlottesville, Virginia newspaper where a lot of this book is set, and said, obviously, the writer loves Central Virginia. And of course I do. It's where I was born. It's my home, and it's fun to do that. And the next book, hitting up Montreal.
Really?
A lot of the books set in Montreal, it's set in Maine and in Montreal.
Oh.
And some of it's going to be around the jazz festival.
Oh, right. You mentioned the jazz musician.
Right.
Okay. The plot thickens.
The plot thickens. I'd tell you more if I knew a lot more. So far, she's in Maine. We're into the book fairly well, and it's getting ready to move into Montreal.
Okay. Perhaps we should end off with another reading. Is that a good idea, or is there... we've got...
How many? A couple of minutes?
Yeah, just a couple of minutes. 2 minutes, so perhaps a shorter reading.
Okay, so I have her on a car trip. She's on her way to Texas, and I'll just read you a little bit.
And just before you start off, I'd like to thank you.
Well, thank you, Deborah.
This has been fun.
It was great. Okay, this is... a little bit of a travel sequence. In Waco, I showed my riders a place, now a spa, where my band had played for a miserable rainy weekend. We'd been promised living quarters for a 3-day gig, only to discover the club owners intended for us to stay in a leaky basement with wet mattresses on the floor and a toilet in the corner without benefit of door or curtain. There had been an incident with a scorpion in a sleeping bag. I now reported these events joyfully. We're nearing Austin, the home of my heart. We sneaked into town on I-35.